Welcome to another episode of Spanish History 101, brought to you by Brian Spain Domain. As I mentioned in the previous episode, we probably wouldn't make it through the entire 15th century, and we were right. There's so much to tell in the final 25 years that it logically makes sense to devote an entire episode itself to that moment. This is a big moment, a huge moment, a major turning point in the history of this country, in the history of Europe, and for many parts of the world too. So it's not to be treated in passing too quickly. There's a lot to say. As we've seen in previous episodes, things are mighty confusing in the kingdoms of Spain at this point. All of the names sound the same. The rulers overlap, the events overlap, the different kingdoms are growing at different rates and are experiencing different moments of bonanzas and crises. But if one thing positive is to come from this mayhem, it's the arrival of the Catholic monarchs, Fernando and Isabel. I prefer to use those names to Ferdinand and Isabella. Their reign would be crucial to this change, and as a result, one monarch is going to emerge as ruler of all kingdoms, and that should make things a little easier to follow rather than mention all of those names and places that sound so much alike. And that's good for you as the listener. And that's because we've come to the stage where we are making the first major step towards the unification of Spain. And it all sort of began with a marriage between a prince and a princess. Sounds like a fairy tale. And in a way it was. Their kings, their respective kings, were against it. And word has it, Fernando of Aragon had to sneak into Castile dressed as a mule driver to meet his bride, Isabel, who was the half-sister of King Enrique IV of Castile. Isabel and Fernando were also second cousins, which was not unusual for that time. Since they were related, they needed the approval of the Pope to consecrate the marriage, but Paul II, the Pope at the time, would have nothing of it because he was opposed to the rising power of the Spanish kingdoms, especially Aragon, which had always taken an interest in Italy. Did that stop the couple? No, it didn't. In fact, they simply had a papal bull made up at home with the local clergy. That's right, they forged it. And with that, the marriage became official. In any event, they married in 1469 and then waited. First in 1474, when Enrique IV died, Isabel quickly ran to the nearest church in Segovia to get proclaimed queen. She was in a hurry to claim the throne because she had some competition from Enrique's daughter, Juana, who also felt she had a right to become the next leader. And in theory, she was right. But there was a problem. Many people said she wasn't actually the daughter of Enrique. Both his virility and his sexual orientation had been called into question, and they said that the true father was actually a member of the court named Beltrán de la Cueva, as a result of a tryst that he had with the queen. Juana was hence nicknamed, to this day, unfortunately for her, La Beltraneja, or the bastard daughter of Beltrán. The debate has never been settled 100%, and there are many who believe she really may have been Enrique's daughter, but who knows? The point is, Isabel was faster and also had Enrique's blessing, and now the young Juana had her work cut out for her. The opposing sides fought it out at the Battle of Toro, and Fernando prevailed in the name of his wife, so that was pretty much settled there. Fernando ascended to the throne of Aragon in 1479, completing what many consider to be the beginning of the unification of Spain. Now, in a technical sense, this simply was not true in any way. The kingdoms of Castile and Aragon, and the regions the kingdoms were comprised of, remained separate entities legally, economically, and so forth. And it would stay that way for a very long time. On top of that, they were very different kingdoms. Castile was slowly asserting its authority over the other former kingdoms, and slowly but surely reining in the feisty nobility. Aragon, on the other hand, was still that conglomerate, almost a holding of different kingdoms and regions, and there the different parts had a lot more power, as did the nobility. So there's no unification to speak of. However, from this moment onward, there would be pretty much only one ruler in Spain, albeit officially the ruler of many different kingdoms, sometimes referred to as the Spains. These were principalities, duchies, earldoms, and kingdoms. So in practical terms, there was some truth to it. However, many regions and peoples would oppose the new situation, and it would be a source of many conflicts in the years to come, and even the centuries to come. And they are conflicts and arguments that still influence Spain's society today, and even Spanish politics. So, to sum up, was this the unification of Spain? Well, sort of, but at best, with a very big not really at the same time. But they were both kingdoms on the rise, especially Castile, which was much larger than its counterpart, both in terms of area and population. Castile's economy at that time depended heavily on the wool industry, which is another story I've promised I'll tell you about at a different time. Aragon looked east to the Mediterranean and tried to foment its trade industry there, which was its strength. Anyway, Fernando and Isabel turned out to be one of Spain's most successful monarchies, power couples. They were both strong-willed, and they worked well together, and together they would set the foundations for the future of Spain as a nation. They did, however, draw up the terms of their professional relationship and agreed that their power and status were equal. A famous, almost enigmatic expression in Spanish is tanto monta, monta tanto, which roughly translates as one as much as the other. This sense of mutual cooperation, this partnership in marriage and parenthood, religion, foreign policy, and domestic policy was probably in many ways the key to their success. Now, their reign would be marked by a number of important milestones, and these were the following. One of them was the creation of what they called the Holy Brotherhood, Hermandad. This was essentially a law enforcement agency, a police force, which was originally set up to deter highway robberies and rural bandits, but it would eventually become part of the state's sort of military force and would increase the power of the monarch in Castile. It was almost Spain's first professional army. And this was also the time when the Inquisition was created in Spain. This was actually approved in 1478, which was before Fernando became king, so we can't say it was 100% part of their reign, but it was at the same time. Pope Sixtus IV approved its establishment in that kingdom, in the kingdom of Castile. It already existed in Aragon since the 13th century, as well as in many parts of Europe, where it had been created to keep heretical ideas in check. This is the famous Spanish Inquisition that has given this country such a bad reputation in history. That's a very long and complicated history, and we are going to talk about it at a different time in depth. Just suffice it to say, for the moment, the purpose of this institution, of this Inquisition, was basically to keep an eye on the Jews and Muslims who had supposedly converted to Christianity. There were reports and rumors and fears that many of them had done it just to appease the population and the authorities, and also to gain certain advantages to becoming a Christian, but in reality were hiding their true religious faith. And this was sort of a watchdog. Ironically, those Jews and Muslims who hadn't converted were originally sort of free of its jurisdiction, and that would be a fact that would weigh heavily on policy changes to come in the near future. Anyway, as I was saying, the Spanish Inquisition almost became synonymous with the institution itself, the word Inquisition, but it existed throughout Europe. This was simply another manifestation of the measures used by the church to keep things under control. Anyway, we'll talk about that more at a different time. Then came 1492. 1492 was an immensely important year, as many of you know, but most will associate it with Columbus's first voyage and the ensuing discovery of the New World. In the long term, this would be by far the most transcendental event of the year, even the century, but it was a monumental year in the Iberian Peninsula for a number of reasons. To kick the year off, you had the final defeat of the Muslims after 780 years since their invasion. This came at the very beginning of 1492, January 2nd to be precise, when Boabdil, the leader, relinquished control over the city of Granada and his beloved Alhambra and departed without a fight. This was the last Muslim stronghold. Now, to be fair, this final assault had taken a while to come. For decades, the Christians failed to finish the job off for a number of reasons, but one was that it was economically advantageous to receive the annual tribute in gold. But once that became more difficult for the Nasrid dynasty, the rulers of Granada, to cough up, Castile decided it was time for the occupants to go. Now, it wasn't a brief operation by any stretch of the imagination. The campaign started in 1482, 10 years earlier, and it would inch its way towards its goal by way of sieges, and was also helped by infighting, a civil war which was tearing apart the Muslims themselves. There weren't many battles to speak of. The Christian forces essentially squeezed their enemies out like a boa constrictor. Fernando ran the armed forces, and Isabel was in charge of many of the logistics, including field hospitals and making sure supplies were reaching the forces. They worked in tandem to perfection, and it was another example of the effectiveness of their work as rulers. So anyway, that was done. It was a successful start to the year. But then Fernando and Isabel switched gears radically and went after another group that was neither Christian nor especially well accepted in society, the Jews. And on March 31st, of 1492, they signed what was known as the Decree of the Alhambra, where the king and queen announced to the Jewish population of their respective kingdoms that they had 4 months to either convert or leave the country. This was the culmination of religious persecution that had affected not only Spain, but the rest of Europe, in some cases for centuries. In fact, Spain was actually one of the last countries to expel the Jews. Many people understandably point to this moment as one of the negative moments in Spanish history, as well as a low point in the reign of Isabel and Fernando. And it certainly was, but the whole story is much more complex. To begin with, Isabel herself expressed in writings on numerous occasions her disgust with the violence and ill treatment of the Jews, especially in the years leading up to the expulsion. She considered them to be her subjects, and it was her duty to protect them from persecution. So what happened between that time and the day they actually signed the law that expelled them from the country is worthy of more in-depth study, and we're going to have to devote an episode to it at another time. It's really quite interesting. Now, if that weren't enough, then we had the discovery of the New World. Later on that year, in August, Christopher Columbus would set sail from Palos de la Frontera with three small ships and head down to the Canary Islands before crossing the Atlantic in an attempt to reach East Asia quicker than the dangerous routes over land and the cumbersome voyage around Africa. On October 12th, they would spot land for the first time, and this would be the beginning of Spain's empire. It almost didn't happen. Fernando was dead set against the mission, the voyage, arguing that Columbus didn't have a prayer in hell of making it to Asia, mainly because his scientific experts, Fernando's experts at the time, believed that Columbus's suggested circumference of the world was well short of the real size. And they were absolutely right. But what they didn't know is that there was a continent that lay between the two, or at least that's what many believe. In any event, the financing of the venture was basically Isabel's doing, and he put his faith in her by signing the Capitulations of Santa Fe in 1492, which gave Columbus the green light. It would take them a while to figure out just what they had come upon, but that's a story for another day. Suffice it to say that Castile and the rest of Spain, but especially Castile, was heading for something big. A few years later, at the Treaty of Tordesillas, Spain and Portugal would essentially divide the future world in two regions, and that would give Spain the vast majority of the Americas. This came under the approval of the Pope, Alexander VI, who just happened to be a Borgia. Now, I'm not sure if everyone knows that, but the Borgias were actually a Spanish family, even though everyone thinks of them as Italian. And the Pope obviously would provide a lot of support to Aragon and Castile. And he was often supportive of the interests of Spain. Now, we are going to get into this age of discovery in the future, so we'll leave it as a major breakthrough for Spain, but especially Castile, since that was the kingdom that had financed the mission, and all economic, military, religious, and political action would be under the authority of Castile for many years. Now, any one of these events that I've talked about and might have made their term as rulers, their reign, quite notable. But the entire lot put together translates into a profound period of change for this country. No questions asked. The Catholic monarchs planned out everything, all the way down to the marriages of their five children, which on paper would ensure a successful future for the dynasty, the Trastamara dynasty, and for their respective kingdoms. Fate, however, would have a different plan in store. In accordance with the Treaty of Alcasovas, which brought the Castilian War of Succession to an end in 1479 and recognized Isabel as Queen of Castile, their first daughter, the first daughter of Isabel and Fernando, would marry the son of Juan II of Portugal and consolidate the close ties between Castile and Portugal. The son was named Alfonso, and he was the crown prince of Portugal. Anyway, Isabel and Alfonso got married in 1490. I think she was about 20 years old, and he was something like 15, an arranged marriage, but they actually fell madly in love with each other. But unfortunately, it didn't last long. Alfonso's horse fell on him Just a year later, in 1491, Alfonso was rushing on his horse to meet his father, the king, to go swimming in a river, of all things. Apparently, he wasn't really keen on the idea, but he didn't want to disappoint his father. And he was galloping so fast that the horse, I think, got tripped up and fell on him and killed him. The story goes that his mother, the queen, Leonor of Visu, was so grief-stricken when she heard the news that she mounted a mule and galloped as fast as she could to be with her son, hoping that he might still be alive, but it was too late. When I first heard that story, I was very much affected by it. I think it's sort of a powerful and tragic image of a queen riding on such a humble animal in search of her dying son. By that I mean she no longer was queen, but just a mother, a suffering mother who was in search of her dying son. So if it is true, if that story is true, it must have accentuated that tragedy. In any event, Isabel, the daughter, the young wife, was herself devastated, and it took her years to overcome it. But things being the way they were back in those days, she married the new king of Portugal, Manuel, as a way of keeping with the agreement of the treaty. Now, Isabel's brother, Juan, the Prince of Asturias, and therefore the heir to the throne to Castile, was on his way to that wedding and the celebration when he died in Salamanca. This was October 4th, 1497. Now, rumor had it he passed away from too much hanky-panky with his young bride, but it was probably a result of some chronic illness like tuberculosis. In any event, this threw Fernando and Isabel's plans off tremendously. They were destroyed by the news. His tomb is in a monastery in Avila, well worth visiting. Now, not all was lost. Isabel, the daughter who had married Manuel, became pregnant, and she gave birth to a son in Zaragoza in August 1497. But she died during the delivery, or at least a few hours after that. So that was the next bit of bad news. Isabel would be replaced as a wife. I hate to put it that way, but it pretty much was like that, by her younger sister, Maria, the fourth child of the family. She would go on to marry Manuel and become the new queen of Portugal. Isabel, the baby she had was a boy named Miguel, and at first he was the heir to all the major kingdoms in the Iberian, on the Iberian Peninsula, except for Navarra. So that would have made him king of basically the entire Iberian Peninsula. However, he died just 2 years later, and that would complicate things even more. That left the next daughter, Juana, to be named heir of Castilla and Aragon if there was no new male child. Juana was married to Philip the Handsome, who was the son of Maximilian I, the Holy Roman Emperor. Juana was probably sorely ill-suited for the job and would go down in history as Juana the Loca, Jane the Mad, a dreadfully unfair name for the last Trastamara Queen of Castile. I've talked about her in a previous podcast. And then finally, you had the youngest of the family, who was none other than Catherine of Aragon, the future wife of Henry VIII, the woman with whom he'd be married for years before deciding to divorce her, and as a result, provoke a major crisis in Europe and the Catholic Church. For the ultra-devout Catholic, Isabel, the mother, that certainly would have been an unforeseen outcome. Fortunately for her, she wouldn't live to see that day. Isabel died in 1504 and bequeathed her kingdom to her daughter, Juana, who at times seemed to show signs that she really wasn't always with it. Her husband, Philip, wanted to take her place, and so did her father, Fernando. Philip won out and became king, but 3 months later, he too died, rather suddenly, making Juana the sole ruler. Now, I'm not a firm believer in fate, but if I were, I'd be convinced that Juana was destined to be Queen of Castile, because just about everyone who had to die for her to end up being the monarch did die. But it wouldn't take long for Juana to begin to show or prove that probably she was in over her head, and she agreed to let her father take over for her as long as he lived, though she would never renounce the throne. She was always officially the queen. And so Fernando carried on with his duties. He also married a pretty 18-year-old woman named Germaine de Foix in hopes that he would have a son, and that son would be able to take over the crown of Aragon instead of his grandson, the son of Juana, Carlos. Carlos wasn't even born in Spain. He was from Flanders, and he had never even set foot in Spain. Fernando did have a son, but the child died shortly after that, and then he never had another baby. Fernando would die in 1516. One of Fernando's final political missions was the annexing of the Kingdom of Navarra in 1512. This happened when Fernando wanted to move his troops into France by way of Navarra. The Navarran said no, so he took over the country and put an end to that opposition. Once that was achieved, basically every bit of territory that makes up modern Spain, including the two major island chains, were now under one ruler. And if you think about it, 40 years earlier, none of that was true. Fernando and Isabel's grandson, Juana's son, Carlos, who, by the way, would end up sleeping with Germaine de Foix, that is his step-grandmother, would turn out to be the first ruler of all the territories of Spain, of the Spains, as some would call it. These kingdoms would preserve their separate jurisdictions, but the road to full unification was underway. There is so much we could talk about when looking at these two fascinating rulers, Fernando and Isabel, and the people who surrounded them, but I think we will stop here because I hope this has given you an idea of just what was going on. In addition to their deeds, feats, and missteps, the Catholic monarchs brought relative stability to a land which had seen crisis after crisis for centuries. Some have even said or asserted that they created the first modern state, and while that would probably be debated by others, there is a fairly understandable claim to be made. It's not completely off base. In a little more than 30 or 40 years, these struggling kingdoms would bond together and launch a country into the center of international attention. And this was just the beginning of that stage. And that will be all for this episode of Spanish History 101. You can subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Apple, Amazon, and Castos. Or if you wish to support Brian's Spain Domain, we greatly appreciate it. We work very hard to provide you with the best information about Spain, Spanish history, Spanish culture. You can do so by clicking on our PayPal donate button, or if you want to have access to absolutely all of our podcasts and support us regularly, you can check us out on Patreon at the link provided below. Stay well, stay safe, and hasta pronto.